back exit. It was all about speed and timing now, and while Court knew he had the speed, he couldn't see the SUV below the lip of the roof, so he had no idea about the timing. If he jumped too soon, he'd land on the asphalt after a 12-foot leap, and he'd probably also get run over by the officer in his sports utility vehicle. If he was too slow, he'd just hit the asphalt behind the vehicle, and no doubt break a leg in the process and lie there till discovered by the cops. Using the sound of the siren as his guide, he ran on, then stutter-stepped near the edge to buy himself an instant of time. He launched off the roof, windmilled his arms and legs through the air, and pounded down feet first on the roof of the SUV, 6 feet lower than the roofline. His forward momentum propelled him off the moving vehicle, and the SUV's forward momentum, as it moved to Court's left, cartwheeled Court sideways. He spun in the air, tumbling down towards the parking lot. He landed on his feet, but immediately crashed to his side, then continued his tumble into a forward roll off his right shoulder. Out of the roll, he snapped back up to his feet. This propelled him on even faster, and in just a few steps, he was back in the air, leaping and then grabbing onto a chain-link fence near the top. Hurriedly, he climbed the rest of the way over. The Montgomery County Police vehicle screeched on its brakes, and the driver put the transmission in park and leapt out. But by the time he got around to the other side of his vehicle to pursue the dark figure who had just crashed down on his unit, the fleeing man had dropped on the far side of the back fence and pushed through a high hedge, and he was now running through the dark parking lot of a dentist office. The two Townsend men were on the dock, but they'd missed the man leaping from the roof. By the time the uninjured security officer saw what was happening and tried to level his pistol at the movement, two police officers inside the restaurant saw him through the open back door and screamed at him, demanding he drop his weapon and raise his hands. The young officer from the SUV watched the fleeing figure clear the hedge on the other side of the fence and run away. He reached for the radio on his shoulder, still not completely sure where the guy came from or whether he was involved in all the gunfire reported inside the building. The cops dragged the two dazed and scalded armed men out of the front of the smoke-filled McDonald's, and they found two more men, dressed the same as the others, in the back alley. One had been shot twice in the lower legs and was dazed by shock and blood loss. But the other operator was more coherent than his colleague, so he relayed a version of events that had all the cops at the scene scratching their heads. The Washington Post's lead national security reporter, Catherine King, reached for the vibrating phone on her bedside table. Looking at the screen, she recognized the number. In a sleepy voice, she said,
"You only call in the middle of the night."
Andy Scholl's voice, in contrast to hers, was alert, almost excited.
"Talk to my editor. I only work in the middle of the night."
Catherine asked,
"What's up?"
"Another shooting."
She began sitting up.
"Where?"
"Chevy Chase," he paused.
"And Bethesda."
Catherine said,
"Two shootings then."
"Sort of just one shooting. Picture a dead rich guy in Chevy, with four of the dead rich guy's security guards chasing the killer a half mile to a McDonald's in Bethesda."
"Wow. Did they get him?"
"He got away, right under the noses of 24 cops."
"And I guess you are calling me because the CIA is there?"
"I don't see anyone who looks like those two from the other night, but the victim is a guy named Leland Babbitt, and on Google it says he is..."
King interrupted. She was wide awake now.
"I know who Leland Babbitt is. He runs a PMC and investigation firm. Government contracts with the intel community."
"Right," said Andy.
"And someone murdered him?"
"Shot him dead, and then fled across a golf course. Got in a gunfight with Babbitt's security men in a McDonald's and then disappeared. I was wondering if you might be interested in coming over and checking it out. I doubt there's any relationship to the thing in Washington Highlands the other night, but considering the occupation of the victim, I thought this might be right up your alley."
Catherine was already moving towards her closet to get dressed.
"I'm coming from Georgetown, 15 minutes to Chevy Chase. Text me the address."
Chapter 28. Court moved calmly through the deep darkness at 2 a.m., avoiding the glow of street lamps and the lights shining from porch lights and the occasional passing car. The streets were quiet here,
a mile and a half from where the action went down an hour and a half earlier. Though he still heard the thumping of helicopters patrolling to the south, they weren't close enough to worry him, and he'd neither seen a police car nor heard a siren for the past 30 minutes. He wore a different set of clothing now. An hour earlier, he'd taken all the clothing he'd worn during the gunfight, every last stitch that had been visible to the shooters, the witnesses, and any security cameras, and he'd shoved them down a drainage culvert. Then he'd pulled a wad of clothing out of his backpack and dressed in a light gray parka, a gray thermal, a pair of black track pants, and a red baseball cap. Now he was walking north on Rockville Pike, feeling good about his chances, but questioning just what the hell had happened back at Babbitt's house. The man had been assassinated, that much was clear, but Court could only make uneducated guesses about who might have been involved. From the first moment it happened, he felt like it must have been a CIA hit. The agency knew Court was here in town, they wanted to get rid of Babbitt for some reason, and the symbiosis of these two things resulted in a shooter on a rooftop near Babbitt's house at the same time Court was ninja-crawling through the man's backyard. Court knew he'd be blamed for the hit. Hell, he would have been blamed even if he hadn't been on the scene at the time. But the entire chaotic escapade with his exfiltration through the McDonald's just played even more into the CIA's plan to pin Babbitt's assassination on him. "This night sucks ass," he mumbled to himself. He'd accomplished nothing this evening, with the exception of getting a crystal-clear understanding that the CIA was going to fight his fire with fire of their own, and the objectives of the CIA were even murkier than he'd imagined. Why the hell did they kill Babbitt? Just ahead was an overpass that ran over the Capitol Beltway. On the other side was an apartment complex, and, next to this, a bus stop where he could take a bus that ran all night. Court knew this bus followed a route that would drop him within a few blocks of his car, about a mile away. He'd passed this stop this afternoon on a bus that got him closer to Babbitt's house, and noted this location as a secondary exfiltration route in case he wasn't able to make it directly back to his car for some reason. His plan for the rest of the evening was simple. Pick up his car, take it back to his storage room, lock it up, then go home to his basement apartment at the Mayberries. But everything changed suddenly when he scanned to his right. There, parked in the darkness of a private driveway, sat a Metro DC police cruiser. The vehicle itself was a little odd, as this was Maryland, after all, but the fact that at least two men sat in the dark car was more suspicious to him. DC cops usually ride alone in their patrol cars. Court began crossing the street, heading away. Behind him, he heard the doors of the police cruiser open. Court looked to his left and right for a place to run, expecting that at any moment the cops were going to call out to him, or else they were right now radioing for backup, and within minutes, cruisers, tactical units, and helicopters would surround him. He looked on either side of the road and saw rows of adjoining houses. Short of kicking in a door or a window, he had nowhere to run.
"And this night keeps getting better and better,"
Court mumbled to himself. Just 50 feet in front of him was the overpass. He knew he'd reach a decision point there. Either he'd turn and run into the neighborhood here, before he got stuck on the overpass. He'd try to run across the overpass and lose the cops on foot over there. Or else he would slide down the embankment and into the traffic of the beltway. No option looked like a good one. But while he kept walking, he couldn't help but wonder why the two cops, just 50 feet behind him now, hadn't challenged him yet. The answer presented itself a moment later when two more Metro PD squad cars pulled onto the far end of the overpass and stopped. Car doors opened, and four police officers poured out, fanned out away from the vehicles, and drew their pistols.
Time to run.
Court turned to his right and raced for the embankment. He had taken only a few steps in this endeavor. He was still 20 feet from the steep concrete slope to the beltway below, when gunfire erupted in front of him.
"What the fuck?"
Court thought. The cops were just gunning him down, not even giving him a chance to surrender. Within the first 5 cracks of incoming fire, Court felt a sharp sting wide on his right ribcage. His gray parka ripped, and he doubled over while running. He stumbled almost all the way to the ground, to the point that his hands went flat on the street, but he kept moving, rose back up, and leapt over the railing of the overpass without taking time to look below. Cort dropped 6 feet through the air and landed on his right hip on a 30-degree concrete incline. He rolled end over end several times, then righted himself and began skidding on his back, picking up speed towards the beltway below. Above him, the gunfire had stopped, but he had no doubt it would resume again as soon as this group of overzealous Washington cops got a bead on him from the overpass railing. He made it to the bottom of the hill, staggered up onto the shoulder, and looked to the oncoming traffic. An idea came to him quickly, and he didn't pause to second-guess it. He timed his move, then jumped in front of a speeding semi-trailer. He raised his hands, shielding his eyes from its headlights. He knew the vehicle would not be able to stop in time. The semi-driver slammed on his brakes, the air brakes squealed and the tires burned and skidded, and the semi's load began to jackknife. Cort leapt out of the way, ran off the shoulder and several feet back up the concrete embankment. As he did so, he felt blood on his stomach, soaking the elastic band of his warm-up pants. As soon as the semi came to a complete stop, Cort drew his Smith & Wesson pistol, ran with the gun in his right hand and his left hand clutching his wounded ribcage, and re-entered the beltway under the cover of the overpass. Behind the semi-trailer, a maroon and white taxicab slammed on his brakes to avoid a rear-end collision, and Cort ran around to the driver's side window and banged on it with his pistol. The cabbie opened the door and raised his hands. He screamed something in a foreign language. Cort thought it might have been Swahili, but he wasn't sure. "Out!" Cort yelled, and the man seemed to understand because he complied instantly. Cort climbed behind the wheel of the cab and threw it into gear. He lurched forward onto the shoulder, did a quick and dirty 3-point turn, and then bounced into the grassy median between the eastbound and westbound lanes. He drove across to the westbound and entered the beltway here, and he stomped on the gas, trying to get as much speed as possible before showing up below the far side of the overpass. He could only hope that the cops above him had not been able to see the carjacking or the maneuver, and that they would only find out about it as soon as they spoke with the furious cabbie. His plan paid off, and within minutes he was miles to the west, clear of the area, and hunting for a place to dump a stolen cab, with blood all over the driver's seat. Chapter 29. Denny Carmichael sat at his desk, his head in his hands. He was back in his suit and tie now, though as soon as he got the energy, he would again dress for bed. 2.5 hours ago, he was moments from flipping off the lights and lying down on the couch, but then came the suspected sighting of Violator at the Babbitt home in Chevy Chase, so he stood by in his office. When the police were dispatched to the scene, he'd received a call from Suzanne Brewer in the Violator Tactical Operations Center on the fourth floor, telling him something he already knew, but he sold his surprise as genuine. He hurriedly dressed and rushed down to the TOC, and here he sat, while Brewer and Mays furiously worked their team of targeting officers. They sent the JSOC Special Mission Unit into the area, but by then, Gentry was long gone. And then, 1.5 hours after the assassination, Brewer and Mays departed for the scene of a carjacking of a taxi 1.5 miles north of Babbitt's house, thinking it possible Gentry was involved in this as well. Denny Carmichael had not heard a word from Kaz since sending the text ordering the Saudi kill team to the scene of Babbitt's killing shortly after 11, and he had no idea if Kaz's men had gotten anywhere near Gentry. So he just sat here at his desk, waiting, trying to get the energy to climb back to his feet. His mobile chirped with the sound it made when an encrypted call was waiting. He glanced down at it and saw it was Kaz, and as he snatched the phone off the desk, he found the energy reserves he was looking for.
"Talk," Kaz said.
"My men made contact with the target."
"When and where?"
40 minutes ago, about 2 kilometers north of the original event.
Carmichael knew this would be the carjacking Mays and Brewer were en route to inspect. He asked,
"How did you find him?"
"Process of elimination.
We saw where the police were focusing their attention. It was mostly to the west, because that was the direction he was last seen moving. But from the radio reports, we determined Gentry originally tried to go south, but that was when he knew he was being pursued. So we felt he was leading forces away from his planned exfiltration route. That led us north. I positioned men in 5 choke point locations and simply waited, thinking he might still be on foot.
What happened?
Carmichael caught himself squeezing the phone so hard he ran the risk of breaking it. 2 of my men saw a lone man fitting the general description. They stepped out to follow him. When my other assets arrived, the man began to run. We engaged, and I am told there was blood at the scene. We are confident that we wounded him.
Carmichael snapped back. But you didn't put him down, did you?
He managed to escape in a hijacked vehicle. Understand, Denny, this operation my men conducted was completely in extremis. If we'd known something about the person the Grey Man was targeting, this Leland Babbitt, we could have been in a much better tactical position.
Carmichael growled now. We didn't know Gentry was after Lee Babbitt either.
Kaz clearly did not believe this. You contacted me within moments of the first shots being fired in Chevy Chase. The only way you could be so on top of the situation like this is if you had some sort of advance warning. Carmichael could not tell Kaz the truth, that they had no advance warning, but had instead been targeting the same man and just stumbled onto Gentry in the commission of their assassination. Instead, he changed the subject.
How badly was he injured?
My assets had to leave the scene before the police arrived. All I know is Violator has been shot.
Very well. I'll try to do better next time with the quality of the intelligence. It would be helpful if your men do better next time with the quality of their marksmanship.
Kaz took his time before replying. We remain at the ready.
Carmichael said, Don't remain anywhere. Keep shaking the trees. He's out there and he's hurt. He'll be easier to hunt.
Court lay in a shallow ditch on his left side, his ears tuned to the sounds around him so he could make sure there was no traffic on the residential road above. After a full minute like this, he felt secure enough to proceed. He used a small penlight to illuminate the right side of his ribcage. Slowly and gingerly, he pushed his torn gray parka out of the way, pulled up his blood-soaked gray thermal shirt, and held the light a little closer. He lifted his head to get a better look, then he dropped it again. Court closed his eyes for a moment, willing away the sight. He knew he'd taken a bullet, but he was hoping it was nothing more than a slight graze. He'd seen enough gunshot wounds in his life to know sometimes rounds could just barely break the skin if they traveled along at the right angle, and these types of superficial wounds could nevertheless be incredibly painful. But now that he'd seen the result of his latest near-death experience, Court realized that even though he would not die from this wound, it was no mere superficial scrape. The bullet had failed to penetrate his ribcage, but it had definitely ripped skin, muscle, and other tissue away, all the way to the bone. It burned and throbbed and stung and ached all at once, and now that he knew what it looked like, it hurt even more. Court made himself look again. A smear of blood covered the right side of his torso all the way down to his waistband, and with help from the flashlight, he could see plainly the dull gray white of bone in the wound. One of his lower ribs was exposed in the seeping hole. He spoke slowly and softly.
Fuck.
He couldn't stitch this up. A half-inch wide and 1.5-inch long swath of skin and muscle was gone, so there was nothing for the sutures to hang on to. Instead, all he could do was clean the wound and cover it with a sterile compress, and tape that down nice and hard so the bleeding would stop. The compress would foul with the coagulating blood, and he'd have to peel it away a couple times a day to clean the wound, an excruciating process he'd have to keep repeating for at least a week. He'd hurt from this, to be sure, but he'd survive, and he told himself this wouldn't slow him down. He'd compartmentalize the pain and keep going. Court pushed it out of his mind now and thought about his situation. He had dumped the stolen taxi deep in the woods in Bethesda, near the Grosvenor metro station. It would be daylight before it was found. He was certain of this. Now he just had to get himself out of this ditch and make his way back to an all-night bus stop, then use the mass transit system to get back to his Ford Escort. His mind went back to the second shootout of the evening. He found himself astonished that a half-dozen D.C. Metro police officers opened fire on him like that when he had no weapon in his hands and without saying anything to him before the shooting began.
Cops don't do that, do they?
For a brief moment, he wondered if those men might have been SAD Ground Branch paramilitary officers disguised as police.
No, that didn't make sense to him. On occasion, the agency could be bold as hell when operating in other countries, but if they were chasing him here in the nation's capital, there was no way they'd be playing by a rulebook that allowed them to impersonate police in the course of an extrajudicial assassination. That was just too ridiculous to contemplate. Court lowered his shirt, closed his jacket, and looked at his watch. It was nearly 3 a.m. He had to move. He had to get someplace to get the supplies he needed to treat his injury, and he had to get home before first light.
"Move your ass, Gentry,"
he said it to himself, and it worked. He pulled himself up into a sitting position, and then, with one hand pressing on his right ribcage, he struggled to stand. As a shockwave of pain jolted him with the movement, he managed to stifle a scream, but he could not manage to suppress a long, low groan. Once up, Court adjusted the position of the Smith & Wesson pistol in his waistband, slipped his backpack over his shoulder, and slowly climbed out of the ditch. Chapter 30 Catherine King and Andy Scholl stood on the shoulder of the Capitol Beltway under the Rockville Pike overpass. Two of the three lanes of traffic had been pylonned off for the police cars, ambulance, and wreckers, so even the two Washington Post reporters had to park up on Rockville Pike and then scoot down the concrete embankment. Once they were here, at least, they were able to walk around the scene and observe the two dozen or so Maryland State Police at work. A helicopter circled overhead, its spotlight scanning around the beltway below, and this, along with passing headlights, flashing red and blue lights from the officers' cars, and a burning flare in the road next to the jackknifed semi, gave a dreamy, psychedelic feel to the scene. The two reporters arrived directly from the scene in Chevy Chase, 20 minutes earlier, after being frustrated by police tape and unhelpful law enforcement there. They'd learned next to nothing about the murder of Leland Babbitt, but when Andy heard the call on his scanner about the violent carjacking on the Beltway, he gave Catherine his professional opinion that there was no way in hell both these things could happen in tranquil western Maryland on the same night without being related. So they set off for the second scene. And here they'd had a little more luck getting information. The semi was more than halfway off the road, with the front wheels of the cab in a ditch next to the shoulder. A group of troopers and other law enforcement officers stood around it. Andy didn't know these men. He visited 3 or 4 crime scenes a day, but always inside the borders of D.C. That said, he did know how to talk to cops, so he finessed his way through the tape and introduced himself to a young detective who helpfully mentioned that the troopers had found blood traces on the concrete embankment and on the shoulder of the beltway. The CSI units were just now setting up lights and starting to crawl around, looking for more samples. The cabbie sat in an ambulance, although he didn't seem to be injured. To Catherine's astonishment, Andy finagled his way through troopers to the open back door of the ambulance and asked the witness for a description of the criminal. The driver was from Mozambique, and his accent was incredibly thick, but he told Andy the man who jacked him had been white, in his 30s, carried a black pistol, and had driven off to the west. Andy wrote the cabbie's name down, making him spell it out slowly and carefully, and then he made his way over to the driver of the semi, who had finished giving a statement to the police and was now waiting for his company to send a tow truck. From him, Andy got essentially the same description, with the additional information that the man was wearing a red or burgundy cap and a gray jacket. He said the man came down the embankment, stood by the side of the road for a few seconds, and then, purposefully, leapt in front of the tractor trailer. Andy walked back over to Catherine, who had knelt down over a splatter of blood the troopers had already photographed and sampled. He stepped up behind her while she took pictures of the blood with her iPhone. He said,
"Both witnesses report one male, 30s, clean-shaven." "That's it?"
"That's it. Didn't remember the color of his hair or his height. Apparently the carjacker caused the cab of the semi to skid off the road, and its load blocked the rest of the traffic from getting by." When the cab driver stopped his taxi behind the truck, the armed assailant showed up at his window. Catherine asked,
"Did either of them mention the gunman being injured somehow?"
"No." She put her phone away and motioned to the red splotches on the side of the highway.
"Is that a lot of blood?"
Andy shrugged. "I've seen crime scenes with about 500 times more."
"Sure," said Catherine, "but there is more blood over there, and CSI found drops on the pavement on the embankment."
"Right.
And the Babbitt shooting happened a little after 11.
"So?"
"So let's assume the shooter is the same person as the carjacker."
Andy smiled. "I'd stake my limited reputation on it."
"Well," Catherine continued, "I'm trying to picture someone bleeding like this for 2 hours.
Andy thought he understood.
"You are saying you don't think the shooter was hurt during the shootout in Chevy Chase?" "What do you think?"
Andy looked at the blood again, both here and on the embankment.
"I'm not a doctor, but I've seen a lot of crime scenes. This isn't arterial spray or anything like that, but this guy was most definitely draining blood." "You're right. No way he bled like this for an hour and a half. He'd be dead, or at least unconscious."
Catherine said,
"If neither witness said anything about the man getting hurt here, there must be a third crime scene somewhere, and that's where he was injured."
Andy said,
"You're pretty good, Ms. King." "I don't have all the answers," she said, "but I know where we can go to get them."
"Where?" Catherine looked behind Andy, and he turned his head to follow her gaze. There, just climbing out of a black Suburban, were Jordan Mays and Suzanne Brewer. They both wore black overcoats, and Mays had two bearded bodyguards with him. Jordan Mays flashed his credos to the detective in charge of the carjacking scene and took the man aside. While the two of them stepped off beyond the jackknifed semi, Suzanne Brewer walked over to the truck driver and began talking to him.
"I'll be damned," said Scholl. "Are you going to ask them what they're doing here?"
Catherine said,
"We both are. Divide and conquer. I'll take Mays."
She started to walk off, then she turned back to Andy.
"Don't mention Brandywine Street. You're just here because this is a crime, and I'm just here because of the Babbitt killing nearby and his ties to the intelligence community."
"Got it,"
Andy said. As soon as Suzanne Brewer finished talking to the truck driver, Andy Scholl caught up to her.
"Hello? Excuse me."
She stopped and turned, extended a hand. Andy knew she thought he was a detective, and he was about to ruin her night.
"Andrew Scholl from the Post. Can I get your name? Do you have a card?"
She pulled her hand away quickly.
"No, sorry."
"Are you law enforcement?"
"Homeland Security,"
she said, and she turned away, making a beeline to the police tape around the blood spatter, thinking it would keep Andy back.
"Really? I just assumed you worked with Jordan Mays over there."
Brewer knelt under the tape, kept walking. After a few seconds, she looked back and saw Andy had ducked the tape as well and remained on her heels. She said,
"Sorry, I'm involved in an investigation here. Will you excuse me?" "Any thought this might have something to do with the Babbitt killing on Cedar Parkway?"
"We are looking into..."
"I mean, it would have to, right? You've got bloodstains here. There was a lot of shooting at the other scene."
"I'm going to have to ask you to step on the other side of the tape."
Her eyes flitted around, trying to find an officer close enough to help her. Andy continued as if he hadn't heard.
"But the weird thing to me is, there's a lot of blood here, especially considering the first event was an hour and a half before the second. No way was some guy going to bleed like that for that long. You have any information about another shooting? Something after Cedar Parkway and before here?
Brewer turned away from Andy, looked around at the crime scene, as if she was considering what the young reporter was saying. After a few moments, her head seemed to clear, and she reached out and grabbed a passing state police officer by the arm.
Yes, ma'am?
Is this reporter authorized to be inside the police line?
No, ma'am.
He squared his shoulders at Andy.
Let's back it up.
Andy pulled out a card and pushed it into Suzanne Brewer's hand. Then he said,
Thanks for talking, Ms. Brewer. I've got plenty to run with for now. Call me if you want to talk more.
Andy turned away, ducked back under the police tape, and headed off to see if Catherine King had gotten any further in her interview. Jordan Mays finished with his briefing from the confused detective with a handshake. The man had no idea who Mays was, but the federal credentials he presented trumped any reticence on the Maryland state officer's part, so he told the man everything he knew about the scene here. Mays turned around to look for Brewer in the large group of men and women working the scene here, but the first person he recognized was Catherine King from the Washington Post. He didn't know her personally, but he read her column and saw her on TV from time to time. He had a vague memory of King being pointed out to him at a cafeteria in the Green Zone in Baghdad years before, and he was introduced to her briefly in one of Saddam Hussein's palaces that had been turned into a coalition command center. He didn't have a clue what she was doing standing under an overpass at 3:30 in the morning.
Mr. Mays? Catherine King, Washington Post.
Mays's defenses fired into high gear, but he was polite.
Ms. King? How are you?
They shook hands.
Please call me Catherine.
Jordan Mays had two bodyguards within arm's reach, but they didn't have any clue that this small woman in an overcoat was a threat to his mission. Mays was stuck talking to her, for a few seconds at least.
Sorry, I'm right in the middle of something.
Wondering if you can tell me if you think this carjacking is related to the Babbitt murder.
Too early to say. I was on my way there and came over here, just out of curiosity. What brings you out tonight?
Same thing, I guess. I'd love to talk to you, off the record, of course. Can you tell me if you think Babbitt's murder was related to the work he did with CIA?
Jordan Mays frowned.
I think you should talk with the Maryland State Police. I can't possibly give you anything more than what they have. If you'll excuse me, that's all I really have time for right now.
Mays felt a muscle in his left eye twitch, and he damned the movement. Catherine saw Mays's immediate discomfort, and she hesitated, unsure just how she wanted to turn up the heat. Quickly, she decided to go for broke.
I noticed you arrived with Suzanne Brewer. She is responsible for protecting CIA personnel domestically, isn't she? Obviously, you must have concerns about Babbitt's killer targeting agency assets.
Mays held up his hands in surrender.
That's a lot of speculation there, Ms. King. Your readers would probably appreciate facts, not conjecture. Like I said, talk to the police.
Now, she decided to drop the bomb.
Well, I would, but I doubt the Maryland police would have much information about that double homicide in Ward 8 the other night. Are you investigating the possibility of a connection to these crime scenes?
Ward 8? I'm not sure I know what you are referring to.
Mays was a good liar, but Catherine knew he would be.
Washington Highlands, Saturday night, Brandywine Street,
she smiled.
You know the one.
I'm sorry, Ms. King. I'll have to break this off right there. If you want, you can call Media Relations, and they...
The agency's media people won't be able to help me on my story. I am aware that you and Ms. Brewer went to the Brandywine Street crime scene the other evening, so I am speculating you had credible intelligence that event was related to a threat on agency personnel. Then, tonight, Babbitt is killed. He was closely affiliated with CIA. You are clandestine service, so I'm not sure what your interest in this is, but...
Mays turned and began walking back to the Suburban. His security men, late to recognize their principal's discomfort, began moving between Mays and the middle-aged woman following him. Catherine backed off with a pleasant,
Good night, Mr. Mays.
She received no reply. Andy and Catherine found each other in the crazed lights of the crime scene a minute later. Andy wore an expression of frustration.
"I didn't get a thing out of her."
Catherine smiled, satisfied.
"I struck out too, but I don't care. Most importantly, we shook the trees a little. I'll reach out to Mays in the morning, ask for a meeting on background with him and Carmichael, and helpfully suggest I might just go to the director's office if I don't get anything from them."
"What will that accomplish?"
"Carmichael doesn't like the director. He doesn't like any director. He resents any oversight. My guess is the director is unaware clandestine service leadership is hanging out with the Maryland State Police. I surprised Mays tonight with what I knew. I could see that. They are going to have to come up with some sort of story for me. It won't be the truth, but they think it will slow me down."
"But it won't?"
"No. Whatever direction they try to send me off in will be a feint, but it will show me to look in another direction. You and I need to keep pounding the pavement on this. It's just getting good."
Andy and Catherine began climbing back up the embankment to their car. Andy said,
"I need to file a story, you know. I'm not an investigative reporter. My editor wants the news, and he wants it now."
Catherine said,
"File what you know, but not what you suspect. Don't mention CIA being here at all, but mention Babbitt's ties to the IC.
But
don't worry, Andy. When I file a story, we'll do it together. Trust me. It will be worth the wait."
Andy smiled as he climbed. Chapter 31. It was just past 4 a.m. when Gentry pulled his gray Ford Escort into the parking lot of the Easy Market on Rhode Island. He was careful to park in the same spot as he did the last time he visited this store, and just as careful to pull his red ball cap down low and to walk where the cameras could not get a look at his face. The same heavy-set young woman with the lazy eye greeted him as soon as he came in the door.
"Hey, baby, how's your night going?"
"It's going," he said.
He held his right arm down tight against his parka, as much to hide the tear and the little stain of blood that he'd been unable to clean off as to put a small amount of direct pressure on his painful wound.
"You must work nights, too,"
she said, but she'd already turned her head back to the little TV behind the counter.
"Yeah," he muttered.
He headed to a back aisle and found a small section with simple first aid items. He picked up an ace bandage and two rolls of gauze, some tape, and a single off-brand bottle of antiseptic. He then stepped back to the cooler, where he hefted a six-pack of beer off a shelf. Lashandra called out to him.
"Oh, I see. You need some beer for a big party over at your place. Suppose my invite got lost in the mail, is that it?"
Court smiled. Then he scooped up a can of ravioli, a loaf of white bread, and a candy bar, and he brought his food and beer up to the register along with the first aid. He fished some bills out of his jacket with his left hand.
"Nah, no party."
"Mm-hmm,"
she said it in a playfully suspicious tone. Court hoped she would be too occupied with her TV show to pay any attention to the other items he'd brought to the counter.
"Oh, baby, you done hurt yourself?"
"So much for that." "No."
"Then what's all this for?"
"Just stocking up on my first aid kit. Going camping this weekend."
"Camping?"
she said, as if it were a preposterous concept.
"I ain't never been camping."
Court did not respond. She began ringing up the items, scanning the gauze, the ace bandage, the tape, and the antiseptic. Once she got to the canned ravioli, she looked up at him again. Court kept his head turned from the camera on his right, pretending to be reading a newspaper on a rack to his left. The injury to his ribcage burned like hell.
"Hey, this ain't your dinner, is it?"
Court shrugged.
"Yeah."
She paused, stopped scanning the food, and Court glanced further to the left. He got the sense she was looking at his face. She said,
"You don't look good."
"I'm fine."
"Nah, you sweating. Your skin is white. I mean, like, really white."
"Allergies. Every spring."
"You need some greens."
"Okay,"
he said, thinking her comment to be rhetorical in nature. When she kept staring at him, he glanced up quickly into her good eye. She said,
"I'm for real. Go get you a can of turnip greens or spinach or something. Don't cost but $2, and you look like you need it."
Court did as instructed, following Lashandra's pointed finger to a shelf. He grabbed a can of turnip greens and brought it back to the counter, set it down, and went back to looking at the magazine rack.
"You know that's real good with some vinegar. You got vinegar at home?"
Court did not.
"Sure do. I'll try it."
A minute later, he was on the way out the door, a little stressed about the level of questioning from the woman, but ultimately satisfied he'd not compromised himself in any way. Court realized that people here in the U.S. were nicer to strangers than in the other places he'd traveled in the past 5 years, when they weren't shooting you in the ribs, that was. And while Court had no problem with politeness, for a man who lived his life moving through society without leaving a trace, this was problematic. As he struggled into the driver's seat, the pain in his torso limiting his movement, he thought he might have to change his late-night shopping habits so he didn't get any more probing questions from the ultra-inquisitive cashier. He suspected Lashandra was a level of chatty not common among most late-night store clerks, so he could just find another place to make his purchases. Court found this unfortunate because he liked the slightly annoying woman. When she called him Baby Doll the first time, he had realized it had been a very long time since anyone had called him by an affectionate name. Court pulled out of the parking lot, a sense of sadness creeping into his normally mission-focused mind. Lashandra would have no way of knowing it, of course, but she had become his best friend. Too bad he would never see her again. A half hour later, Court knelt in the alley that ran catty-corner to the Mayberry home on Northwest Quincy Street, and he eyed the area around his rented room. He'd been here for nearly 10 minutes, watching the scene, his bags from the market by his side. It would be dawn in a little while, but he was using the security afforded by darkness to survey the neighborhood, making sure he had not been followed or his hide had not been otherwise compromised. It had been a shitty night. His covert B&E had turned into a mad run for his life, a leap from a rooftop, explosions and wild-assed trigger-happy police officers, helicopters, and even a gunshot wound thrown in for good measure. Jesus Christ. Court had planned it very differently, to say the least. He checked his watch, looked to the sky, and told himself he needed to be in the room well before first light, so he stood and crossed the street, all the while half expecting the pops of guns or the wail of sirens. The neighborhood remained quiet. He entered his room at 6, peeled off his clothes, inspected bruises and scrapes that would get no more attention, and cradled his forearm in his hand. He'd not rebroken it. He was sure of this because he knew exactly what it felt like when it was broken. But the tissue around the injury had not appreciated the way Court had decided to spend his doctor-ordered convalescence. He wanted to jump into the little shower, but he fought the urge for a few minutes so he could restage his booby trap by the front door. Once he had his device assembled and set, he headed for the tiny bathroom at the back of the apartment. Court took a hot shower. The water stung like hell in his gunshot wound, but he powered through it, careful to make sure he washed out any foreign debris lodged deep in the sticky mess. He then toweled off as well as he could with the wounded ribs and poured antiseptic onto a thick wad of gauze. Carefully, he placed it over his injury, and he used the ace bandage to secure it by wrapping it all the way around his torso several times. That done, Court redressed in a fresh set of dark clothing and put on a pair of black running shoes. He pulled the one tray of ice out of his little refrigerator freezer, and he moved into the closet. Here he lay on his back, the Smith & Wesson on his chest, and his right arm resting on the ice tray at the point of most discomfort. He fell asleep like this at 6:45, and he dreamed of killer cops. Chapter 32. Zach Hightower entered the Violator Working Group's Tactical Operations Center promptly at 8 a.m., clean-shaven for the first time in 2 years, and professionally dressed in a blue suit with a regimental tie. He was feeling better than he had felt in a long time, because he was back on the job, part of the team, and operational. True, at this point he hadn't worked out his official status, or even whether he would be getting a paycheck for his services, but he didn't care. Maze and Carmichael knew what he did, and men like Maze and Carmichael needed a man like Zack Hightower. More work would follow, Zack was sure of it. Hightower was not surprised to see Suzanne Brewer already hard at work in the TOC. She was that kind of executive. Hightower had seen the type a few times before, always from distance, because he was labor and they were management. Brewer would come early and stay late, and she'd make this operation her life for the duration of it. Then she'd move on to something else. But wherever she'd go from here, she would always move up. She would always leverage her access and her associations to serve as rungs on a ladder. She'd step on Zack's head to help her climb up if she needed to. Of this, he had no doubt. Brewer wasn't the type of person Zack looked up to, but he'd been around the agency long enough to know a high flyer with seventh-floor potential when he saw one. That was who she was. And, Zack being Zack, he couldn't help but think about getting her glasses off and her smart business suit wadded up at the foot of his bed. He pushed the imagery out of his mind and went back to business. He imagined Brewer was the type who would keep her nose clean at all costs, and that meant, he knew without having to be told, that she would know nothing of his extracurricular activities the evening before. She was in programs and plans, but she wouldn't dip her toe into non-sanctioned programs or plans such as an extrajudicial killing in the USA for all the money in the world.
"Morning, Miss Brewer," he said as she hurried over to him.
Brewer wasn't a chatty person. She was all business.
"Good, you're here. I need to fill you in on what happened last night."
"Please do."
Zack feigned surprise and interest, and the two of them stepped into a small, glass-walled conference room. As she sat down, she said,
"Around 11 p.m. yesterday, Cortland Gentry murdered Leland Babbitt, director of Townsend Government Services."
Zack just said,
"I'll be damned."
He smiled inwardly, thinking he deserved a fucking Oscar for his acting abilities. He wasn't surprised in the least that Gentry was getting fingered for the hit. Daddy Carmichael was a crafty old fox, after all. She continued,
"Shot him in the chest, then led Babbitt's security detail on a chase across Chevy Chase and Bethesda."
He blinked.
"Oh."
Zack's surprise was authentic now. Apparently they had hard evidence Gentry was there at the scene. But Zack still had to employ his acting talents because it was becoming clear Gentry had been in range of Zack's Remington, and Zack had failed to see him.
"That is very interesting."
He said it as slowly and flatly as he could.
"Any idea where he went?"
"He was tracked from Babbitt's house and was cornered for a short time until he blew up a McDonald's."
"He did what?"
"Yeah, tossed nearly 100 rounds of ammo into a fry cooker."
Zack burst into laughter.
"Holy shit! Kill anybody?"
"No, luckily. Two Townsend men are going to have some pretty bad sunburns for a while. Another security officer was shot in the legs."
"And then Violator just vanished?"
"For 90 minutes. Then he turned up on the Capitol Beltway, where he first caused a traffic accident and then carjacked a taxi. The cab was discovered just 20 minutes ago in Bethesda. No sign of Gentry, though there was blood at the scene of the carjacking, and significant blood in the vehicle."
Zack said, "So he's hurt, but apparently not so badly he can't ninja his way across the greater metro area."
"Exactly. Since about 3 a.m., we have been monitoring hospitals, all-night pharmacies, and minor emergency clinics, expecting him to show up for supplies. Nothing so far."
Zack shook his head.
"He won't go to a hospital or a clinic. He'll treat himself. If he didn't already have wound management supplies, he'll get them at a grocery store or a corner market or a vet clinic, because he'll expect you to monitor video feeds at pharmacies. There can't be more than a dozen that are open all night around here."
Brewer nodded thoughtfully.
"That makes sense. Any other suggestions?"
Just then, Jordan Maze leaned into the TOC.
Sorry, Suzanne. I'll need to borrow Zack for a few minutes. I'll send him back down when I'm done.
Zack followed Mays up to 7, neither man speaking the entire way. The older man with the white hair looked exhausted, which Zack found hilarious, because he had been the one in the field the night before, not Jordan Mays. Zack was late 40s. Mays was just a few years older, but Mays was a suit. Zack told himself he wouldn't let himself go to pot like Mays when he hit his 50s. Hell, not even when he was 85. They entered a small private conference room, and Zack expected to see Carmichael waiting for him. But the room was empty. Mays motioned for Zack to sit, and Mays then took the chair next to him. Hightower understood now. Denny was using Mays as a cutout. Mays would provide a barrier between the shooter and the man who gave the term order. He'd expected instant and profuse gratitude from Mays for killing Babbitt, but what he got was something quite different. Mays began.
You had eyes on the rear of Babbitt's property. How is it you didn't see Violator?
Zack wasn't ready to go on the defensive, so it took him a moment to answer. Finally, he said,
I guess that's why they call him the Gray Man. He probably got into position before I arrived. He had a secure hide site. I was focused on the target and the target security.
And after? Babbitt's men saw him. Why didn't you?
Hightower's square jaw flexed.
After I smoked my target, I hit the bricks. Nobody said anything to me about Babbitt being a potential gentry target.
Mays sighed.
Still, you knew gentry was on the streets. A little vigilance on your part, and you could have killed 2 birds with 1 stone last night. This op would be over.
Hightower was no longer on the defensive. Now he was pissed. No seventh-floor suit was going to tell him how to do wet work.
Look, if you'd integrated me into this op a little bit more, let me know about the connection between Gentry and Babbitt, whatever it was. I could have done your analysis for you.
Zack shrugged.
You just brought me into this to be a trigger puller, so I just pulled the fucking trigger.
Mays let it go.
Very well. Denny and I are satisfied with the Babbitt termination.
Zack wanted to say,
I killed the motherfucker for you, why wouldn't you be satisfied?
But instead, he forced out a, glad to hear it.
Next time, send me after Gentry, and I'll get Gentry. It's as simple as that.
Chapter 33 Denny Carmichael stared at his computer monitor, the thick worry lines in his forehead tight with concentration. He was reading the website for the Washington Post, and on it, an article filed at 6:15 a.m. by Metro reporter Andrew R. Scholl. The story laid out the bare bones of the killing of Leland Babbitt, the escape of the killer, and a carjacking 90 minutes later that, police were saying, might have been related to the earlier crime. There was no mention of Catherine King in the article, and she was not included in the byline. But Denny had heard all about her surprise appearance at the scene last night, and her proclamation that she knew Brewer and Mays had been in Washington Highlands at the site of Gentry's first act in the area. There was also no mention in the piece of the 2 CIA employees the Post reporters ran into at the carjacking scene, and while Carmichael was thankful for this, he presumed Catherine King would be working on that end of the story, and he'd be forced to deal with her soon. Actually, he was certain of this, because shortly after 8 a.m., the Washington Post investigative reporter herself had called Denny's office, asking his secretary for a meeting on background with the director of NCS. Denny didn't know if King was just fishing, or if she had some clearer picture of what was going on. The fact that she knew Mays and Brewer had been in Washington Highlands Saturday night was a problem, because now there was no way he could claim the agency's appearance in Chevy Chase was only a curiosity about Babbitt's killing and not part of something that they had known about for several days. Carmichael's secretary came over the intercom, breaking his train of thought.
Sir, Suzanne Brewer of Programs and Plans is asking for 5 minutes.
He tapped the intercom button.
Send her in.
Brewer stepped into the office, and Denny found himself impressed with just how good she looked, considering he knew she had been wandering around murder scenes at 3:30 that morning. As always, she was all business.
"I just got the preliminary autopsy report on Babbitt. It doesn't fit the witness statements at all."
She handed the paper over the desk, and Carmichael took it. He adjusted his reading glasses and began skimming it. While doing so, he asked,
"What do you mean it doesn't fit?"
"The coroner recovered fragments of a .308 round from Babbitt's lung."
"And?"
"That's a rifle caliber."
Carmichael looked over his glasses at the younger woman.
"I am a Marine, Suzanne. I know what kind of weapon fires a .308.
"Of course you do. Forgive me. I've been talking to analysts all week. You know that's a round commonly fired from a sniper rifle. Not always, but certainly it must be fired from a rifle. But the Townsend guards say they first encountered the masked subject in Babbitt's backyard, less than 40 yards away from where Babbitt was shot. Certainly not a sniper's distance. Plus, the subject was not carrying a rifle of any kind, nor was there a rifle found in Babbitt's yard. It's going to take a while to get ballistic results back, but when we do, I feel sure it's going to indicate the rifle was fired from somewhere else, meaning Gentry could not have been the shooter."
Carmichael took another moment to skim the report. While he read, Jordan Mays entered the office. He and Brewer chatted softly about the coroner's finding. Finally, Carmichael looked up from the paper.
"Apparently the security men were mistaken. They thought they saw someone on the property, but it wasn't until they were out on the golf course that they actually came across the fleeing suspect. According to reports, he was wearing a backpack. Perhaps he had time to break down his weapon. Remember, this is Violator. He could probably do that in 2 seconds."
"I thought of that, but there is something else."
Carmichael's eyes flitted to Mays, but then they rested again on Brewer.
"Go on."
"Saturday night in Washington Highlands, our target risks life and limb to obtain a small-caliber pistol, killing 2 people in the process."
"So?"
"So does it make sense that Monday night he assassinates a man with a sniper rifle? Where did he get the gun? Did he have it Saturday?"
Carmichael shrugged.
"Maybe you're overthinking it. We suspect he also took money from the Aryan Brotherhood dealers. Maybe he didn't need the weapon, but finding the little pistol was just a happy accident, so he grabbed it. He could have a weapons cache the size of a Walmart, and we just don't know about it."
Brewer thought it over a moment.
"True, but one other thing worries me."
Now Carmichael sighed audibly.
"Let's hear it."
"The reporter from the Post pointed out all the blood on the beltway and asked me if there was some other crime scene. He thought the shooter had been injured somewhere after the Babbitt killing, considering the fact he couldn't have possibly bled like that for an hour and a half."
"And what do you think that means?"
I don't know."
"You have a lot of questions, but no conclusions."
"Agreed. I just feel like we are missing an important piece of what is going on here."
Denny said,
"I don't mind you speculating, but your job is not to solve a murder. It is to prevent Gentry from threatening agency personnel."
"I understand that, sir, but if there is more than one attacker, or if I am looking for the wrong man..."
"You are not looking for the wrong man. Gentry has killed agency assets many times before. He has killed people here in D.C. this week, and I'm quite certain he killed Babbitt. Gentry, an assassin, arrives, and 2 days later, the man formerly in charge of hunting him is assassinated. That's proof enough as far as I'm concerned. And there is no one else involved, because Gentry works alone. Trust me, I've been chairing the Violator Working Group for 5 years. You've been with us for less than 3 days."
Chastened, but clearly unconvinced, Brewer said,
"Yes, sir, of course you're right."
As soon as she left the office, Carmichael looked up to Mays. In an accusatory tone, he said,
"You brought her into this operation."
Mays said,
"I did, and for good reason. Look, Denny, we hit a patch of terrible luck when Hightower and Gentry both went for the same target at the same moment. That complicates things in the short term, but it's nothing to worry about long term. Brewer will do her job.
She knows she's not here to investigate a murder.
Denny let it go, rubbing his tired eyes.
Gentry has acted the last 3 nights in a row. Let's plan on being ready for his next move this evening.
Mays nodded.
I've doubled the men watching Hanley's home. 2 sniper teams now. Violator's other known associates are fully covered. He might be good, but he's not going to reach out to anyone here without us seeing him.
Carmichael said,
I hope you're right. What about this other problem?